way, after midnight tonight, you can hear my conversation with the comedian Michael Spicer, the man made famous with his very funny skits, The Room Next Door. It's just genius, some of the stuff that he does. You can hear my conversation about him, his career, and his new Radio 4 series. That's coming up shortly.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Justine Green. The government has announced it's sending £5 million worth of humanitarian supplies to help civilians in Lebanon. The aid will be distributed by the United Nations. In New York, the organisation is holding an emergency meeting of its Security Council to discuss the situation in the Middle East. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned the situation in Lebanon is dire.
Hell is breaking loose in Lebanon. We should all be alarmed by the escalation. Lebanon is at the brink. Since October, nearly 200,000 people within Lebanon and over 60,000 from northern Israel have fled their homes. Many lives have been lost. All these must stop.
Network Rail says there's been a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations. Customers were directed to websites containing what the company says was inappropriate material before their Wi-Fi was suspended. An investigation is underway, but the BBC understands customer data wasn't compromised. The government has insisted its planned cuts to winter fuel payments for pensioners will go ahead after a motion to abandon the policy was passed at the Labour Party conference. Ministers say they're means testing the benefit to cover the hole in the finances left by the Conservatives. Our political correspondent Ian Watson has more details.
Labour's first conference as a government in 15 years should have been a celebration. But with some difficult decisions already taken, enthusiasm amongst the rank and file has been diluted by disquiet. Some of the big trade unions are unhappy with the decision to restrict winter fuel payments to the poorest pensioners. The leader of the Unite Union took the issue to the floor of Labour's conference and called for the decision to be reversed. The unions say that the Labour leadership could have taxed the wealthiest in society instead. The Labour conference did vote against the winter fuel cuts, but this is not binding. Unless there's a subsequent U-turn, the policy will go ahead.
Google is accusing Microsoft of anti-competitive practices. Google Cloud has filed a complaint with the European Commission, saying Microsoft is unfairly operating when it comes to cloud computing. Microsoft says it expects the legal action to fail. A man from Warwickshire who survived being dragged by a hippo to the depths of a river in Zambia says he doesn't hate all hippos, he's just not very fond of one in particular. Roland Cherry, who's 63, had major injuries after he was tossed in the air like a rag doll while he and his wife were on a canoe safari. He says the experience won't stop his appreciation of the natural world.
I'm conscious we were in their territory. Subsequently, it's turned out that it was a female hippo with a calf who was very protective, but no, I don't hate hippos. I don't hate any wildlife because we were there to see the natural world and we wanted to see it. But I didn't want to see it that close up, really, perhaps.
And the weather, rain across large parts of England will push eastwards. Showers too for Wales and Northern Ireland. And it will be driest in northern and central Scotland. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past 12.
Matt Shawley.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Lisa Nadi, such a safe culture major as well.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley.
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network.
Johnny Ianson.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, yes, welcome back. Thanks ever so much for your company tonight. Johnny Ianson in for Gordon. And if I might, I'm going to replay an interview now that I did a few months ago with the brilliant comedy writer and performer Michael Spicer. I'm sure you'll know him for his videos, The Room Next Door, where he plays an increasingly panicked advisor trying to guide well-known political figures through calamitous real-life interviews as they fumble over their words, well and truly putting their foot in it. Here's Michael helping former Prime Minister Boris Johnson on an interview about the Brexit negotiations.
but it might be possible. Well,
for instance, as we come
GAT 24 paragraph 5B.
GAT 24 paragraph 5B that
both sides agree to a standstill.
How would you handle paragraph 5C?
Don't panic. I've got this.
I would
confide entirely in paragraph 5B.
I would confide entirely in paragraph 5B, which is enough for our purposes.
Of course you know what's in 5C. Do you think you'd be running for leader of this country and not know everything that was in Article 24 of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade? Tell him.
No.
Oh, you stupid sausage roll!
His put-downs are just genius. He's been making sketches for years, but it was the Room Next Door series that's earned him more than 100 million views online. When I spoke to him back in June, he just released a new sketch show for BBC Radio 4 called No Room, which pokes fun at culture, politics and everyday life, including an MP's hopeless social media videos and a billionaire who just wants to be popular. Both those things sound quite familiar, don't they? It's taken Michael Spicer around 2 decades to get to this point. So how did he do it?
I was always interested in comedy. It's always what I wanted to do, right from a very, very early age. And it wasn't until I sort of... Well, I was in college and I started writing sitcom scripts and comedy scripts. I was also sending things to Radio 4 and Radio 5, because Radio 5 back then were accepting comedy and drama. It was back in the day when Radio 5 didn't really know what it was.
Right.
And I did submit a sitcom to them, which they were actually interested in for a time. And I was just sending kind of, you know, one-off gags to Spitting Image and people like that. So I was always interested in comedy and I was always doing things, short films, sketches. Occasionally I did some stand-up. I was doing all sorts of things, but it never paid the bills, not until Room Next Door. So I was in a regular 9-to-5 job up until that point.
Why wasn't it happening, do you think? What was it that was preventing you from getting over the threshold?
I was no good. I think, crucially, I knew I had something, but I didn't have, it wasn't fully formed.
Right.
So there were always little signs along the way that I was on the right path. But in my 20s and 30s, I think I was too influenced by my comedy heroes, for instance, rather than finding my own voice. And it wasn't until sort of mid-30s, I guess, that I was starting to write stuff that you would call original.
Mm. How did you stay, well, hopeful? And how did you stay in a place where you thought, okay, I'm still going to follow this because I think there's a career in it? Or did it just become a hobby or just something you did?
I'm not really good at anything else. And I am very, very passionate about comedy and writing and comedy performing. And it is the thing that was fueling me the whole time. So, yes, rejections were always awful. But I would often take a day off and then go, right, what shall I do now? What's the next thing that I can concentrate on? It never, ever felt like I should give up. There were too many signs that I was on the right path. And it was always a therapeutic thing for me as well. When I was unemployed, I would write lots and lots of stuff. And I knew that I was getting better every time I started writing something.
Mm. I think there's a lot to be said for that, isn't there, in taking the enjoyment in just something that you love doing and also actually enjoying the process of it. You know, if you can see improvements, then isn't that sort of makes it worth it, right? If it doesn't mean you're having to sacrifice other things in your life because of it, and you can somehow find that bit of a balance. If you feel like you are getting better, we're all here just to try and improve that little bit, then maybe that's the point of it anyway.
Yeah, I think I was always good with balance. I think I've never really got to a point where I've had any kind of, you know, luckily, I've not had any kind of breakdown or a crisis of confidence. You know, I've always felt like I've had that balance in my life. So yes, there was always those frustrating moments where you were kind of trapped in a 9-to-5 and thinking, what on earth am I going to do to get out of this? Because this is making me unhappy. But then I would just, you know, I would go home and I'd write a few more pages of what I was working on at that point, you know. And it is it is draining. You know, a lot of people, when they come home from work, just go, right, I'm going to eat and I'm going to go to sleep.
Of course.
Because I'm exhausted. But I just tried to find that extra little sort of... It's like the Room Next Door sketch was just like me going, well, I could do this sketch, but I really want to go to bed. Oh, well, let's just quickly do it then. I'll sit on my sofa and I'll knock it out quickly. Well, and then woke up the next day and I went viral.
Yeah, that proved to be a pretty savvy move. Well, I want to talk to you about that in a moment, but one thing I wanted to talk to you about as well was you were sort of skirting around the peripheries of I guess, mainstream success, weren't you? You were on The MASH Report with Nish Kumar and Diane Morgan, brilliant Diane Morgan, in the sitcom Mandy. I was watching lots of your old videos on YouTube and your skits you were doing with Diane Morgan about 10 years ago on there.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what is it like to see your friends and peers start to have that mainstream success and you not? What is success, Michael? What is success? But what is it like to see them, I guess, get to a place where you want to be and you're still having to work full-time at copywriting or working at a shipping company as you were?
I think ultimately it is down to the fact that we all go through this kind of period. So basically, a perfect example of this is, and I've said this before, but this is when Diane first messaged me on Twitter. I basically posted a short film that I did. And I, you know, just to say, you know, I've done this thing. If you watch it, that'd be nice, whatever. And Diane messaged me, and she didn't know who I was, and she said, you know, this was really funny. I enjoyed it, and I think you and I have got the same taste in comedy, and we should work on something together. And you know, I got that message at work, you know, on a dreary Tuesday afternoon, and it felt like a hand coming out of the monitor to grab me. And when I met her. And we chatted about, you know, getting chances in this industry. She said that she was working in a call center, and Peter Kay called her and said, you know, would you like to be in my sitcom?
Really?
Which was Phoenix Nights. And so we've all got these little moments, I think. And being in the same room as Diane, you know, with all that, you know, because she is one of the funniest people I've ever met. And when you're in a room with her, you don't ever feel like, oh, God, it's never going to happen for me. Because literally you're doing something with her and you're thinking, well, it might happen eventually, like it happened for her. Why can't it happen for me? And it did. So I was right.
Yeah. Well done for carrying on that self-belief. Because you need it in that industry, I imagine.
Oh, it's so important.
Yeah. You mentioned about not necessarily knowing what it was that you wanted, but there was something there. And I think you can see that when you look back through your old YouTube videos. And kudos for you for leaving them all up there, by the way. Because a lesser man would have taken them down, because some are, 14 years old, I think the oldest one is.
14 years,
Production techniques have changed a lot since those days, Michael.
Massively.
But, you know, watching your first one, which is you playing a sort of geeky guy teaching us how to hack into Twitter. You were an early adopter of that platform, doing your own comedy.
Yeah.
And I wondered, did you realise that there was something there, or was it just another outlet for you to get out there and be funny?
Well, I was never a stand-up comedian, and I always felt frustrated by that because, you know, like the Edinburgh Festival felt like that platform. And if I just did an hour show and went to the festival, what would happen? But I was never really confident on the stage. I think I'm better at it now because I have been on tour. But people came to see me because of Room Next Door. And I was never comfortable just going on stage with nobody knowing who I was. So that was, that whole area was cordoned off from me. And when I started noticing people were doing tiny, no production values at all, little sketches online, it was a light bulb moment for me. And I thought, yeah, why not? I can just quickly do that. In fact, when I did my first few sketches, I did just post them on chat forums and say, My friend did this.
Really?
What do you think?
Did you?
I was so awkward and uncomfortable about it. But I grew in confidence simply because Twitter encouraged it. It was nothing like it is now. It felt like a very friendly community with the occasional famous person dotted about, you know, who would kind of encourage you. You know, one of my first, I had like 12 followers when I put that Twitter, how to hack into Twitter sketch up. And like one of those followers was like Sharon Horgan, who said, you know, I think you're very funny. Oh, and so is that kind of sign where you think, well, I must be doing something right.
Yeah.
I must be doing something right. I'm just not sure what it is. But yes, doing a sketch and instantly putting it on Twitter creates a kind of, especially if it's topical in any way, it creates this kind of energy, this need to want to share it because it made you laugh and it's about a particular thing that's happening in the news or whatever.
Well, I highlighted perfectly with that Boris Johnson skit, 2019, you see Boris Johnson giving this frankly incredible interview about what he likes to do in his spare time, which turns out to be making buses out of old crates. And you thought, okay, maybe this is the thing. Did you think that? Yeah. Did you think this is the thing? Or did you just think, okay, I've got an idea and we'll see where this goes?
Yeah, it was just that, really. Because I had gone viral in the past, and what it taught me was that it didn't really amount to anything because you would just be forgotten the next day. But the difference with this was that this character was going viral each time I did him. And I think why it gained momentum so quickly is because the very next day, the Dalai Lama had a car crash interview after Boris Johnson.
Yes.
And people said to me, he should have had the man in the room next door for that character. And that's when I thought, oh, right. I've created a character I can use a few times here. I didn't realise I'd be doing them about 70 times. but it was still an important moment for me in terms of knowing how I could utilise Twitter and social media.
Yeah. And it's interesting because going viral, it is a very ephemeral thing, isn't it? People have this really intense amount of intention for a day or two or a week, and then more times than not, it just disappears.
Yes.
And you were aware of that maybe this just kept cut. There was an ebb and flow, and actually you were maybe going to have to do more than just be viral every now and again.
Yes. Yes, it's weird going viral because you can come up with one sketch and people enjoy it and then they move on. A lot of things I did in the past that went viral were hoaxes. People were hoaxed. They thought these things were real that I was doing. I did a fake transcript between Tony Blair and Bill Clinton because he released lots of real phone transcripts. And I slipped a fake one in there and everybody thought that that was real too. And that went viral. And then I had interviews with the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, I think, to try and establish that this wasn't real. And of course, people were going, "Oh, fake news!" but it wasn't fake news. What I was doing was I was trying to make people laugh. I didn't realize that half the world would fall for it. So things like that, it was like a sort of 48-hour period, this cycle, you know, and then it died down.
Yeah.
And I just thought that that would happen this time round. But when you've got a character that you can stretch and adapt for different scenarios, then there is some longevity there. And he doesn't live in any particular world. You know, he lives in a world where he represents Boris Johnson one week, Keir Starmer the next, Donald Trump after that, and then, a football manager after that. It didn't really matter to me as long as there was comedy in it.
Has he got a name, by the way?
No.
Have you ever been tempted to? I guess there wouldn't be a reason to because he never interacts with anybody. But, you know, when people talk, when authors and screenwriters and I guess comics have characters in their heads, they're fully formed, aren't they? They have a full legend, as they call it, where they go shopping, who they're married to, what they like to do on a weekend.
Nah.
No.
No, it was just me with a pair of headphones.
What are they plugged into, by the way? They just dangle around the side of you?
They did dangle around, and then a headphone company sent me some really snazzy ones.
Oh, nice.
I didn't do anything. I didn't promote them or anything. They just said, oh, have them. Went, oh, okay.
Okay, great. I'll use those to go jogging.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about the character as the man in the room? Did he sort of changed over time a little bit? Because I seem to, maybe I'm imagining this, but with the Boris Johnson one, he was telling him the stupid stuff to say, right? Whereas the character quickly became, what are you doing? Don't say that, you buffoon. Say something else.
Yeah, no, that's very true. There was this element of the advisor having a moral compass and telling him to say the right things, tell him to say the things that should be said, and the jokes coming from the fact that they say the exact opposite. That's the joke. But the beginning, yes, exactly. It was me trying to come up with the lies. but obviously I found more material in the fact that here was a group of people who were saying all the wrong things, sometimes saying the opposite of what they should be saying, and me there pulling my hair out, which made for more of a, I think that kind of character chimed more with audiences.
Yeah.
Because they're also on their sofa screaming at the telly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. And we'll talk about the fact that they sort of give you 90% of your material in a moment. But that's linked to the fact that I wonder what role that timing had in the success. People, you know, that cliche of timing is everything. But the pandemic, it was a really divisive time in politics. Boris Johnson, Donald Trump. You know, it was sort of ripe for doing something very simple, which is you pretending to be sat in the next room trying to stop them saying silly things.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, you know, I don't know whether it would have really taken off were it not for all of those different things happening all at once. I mean, extraordinary time. What an extraordinary time it was. 2019... is it still happening? Is it still going on now? Is this period of time, is this the period of time that they'll be looking back on? Maybe. But yes, with this, you know, the turnover of prime ministers, just that alone is absolutely remarkable. And just the added storm of Trump, Brexit and
Brexit.
The election that
I
we
forgot
had
about
in,
that one as well. Yeah.
Brexit, yeah, forget about Brexit. I mean, that's how chaotic it all is. So yes, I do think that it created this kind of spike on social media in terms of people comedians who felt they had to say something about what was going on, even if it was just Sarah Cooper lip syncing Donald Trump's speeches.
Mm. We are talking to Michael Spicer, the man known for his satirical videos, The Room Next Door, and he has a new series out as well on Radio 4 called No Room. The whole thing is on BBC Sounds at the moment and is currently on Radio 4 as well, heading towards episode 9 and 10. It's interesting, that idea of timing as well, because it's a very different ideal to what Alistair Campbell, the sort of Blair spin machine of the 90s, had in approaching interviews. And I just wonder how much material you would have got out of Tony Blair or Mandelson or whoever at the time, because everything was so much more polished.
Yeah, virtually none. I don't think I would have got anything out. I mean, maybe George Bush, yeah, absolutely.
Maybe a bit out of John Prescott. Maybe John Prescott.
Yeah, there was an interesting sort of dynamic there, wasn't there? But there was never enough to really get your teeth into.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Armando Iannucci tried quite hard with his Saturday Night Armistice show, which came along during Tony Blair's ascension in 1997. And he still found material he could use. But it was quite interesting, really, because I felt like there was a bit of resistance to him poking fun at Tony Blair at that time. He really could do no wrong.
Yeah.
But yes, it was a spin machine that was very difficult to dismantle. And it wasn't until You've got the likes of Boris Johnson and Donald Trump coming across as the everyman, somebody who wasn't going to be tied down, who was somebody you could have a pint with, et cetera, all those ridiculous cliches, and then finding out they were worse than anything that's gone before.
And I mean, it's also helpful that you have Boris Johnson stood on stage waving a kipper around, or Donald Trump advocating...
I mean, what? Gold!
Donald Trump, gold! Donald Trump advocating injecting yourself with bleach to try and solve... Yeah. Coronavirus. Yeah. I mean, it does write itself, and in a way, it's strange because they are the satirists, and really, you are there just to say, "Sorry, can we just stop for a minute? Because this is crazy, what's happening right now."
Yeah. Yes. It is just holding a mirror up to it, and that's why they are difficult to parody. You know, hats off to Dead Ringers and Spitting Image for trying to parody that kind of thing. But I find that incredibly difficult. Mm. I think it's much better to just, you know, take their interviews and put them in my sketch because that's the easiest thing you can be doing. I mean, I hope that, you know, there have been moments where students have, media studies students and political students have come to me and tried to get quotes and that sort of thing, because they're doing dissertations about satire and politics and how what I was doing was joining the dots rather than actually coming up with any fully formed creative parodies.
Well, you are excellent in your withering put-downs. They are very creative. I love those.
Thank you.
Some of my favourites include... In fact, I'll tell you what, I'll read out the put-downs and you have to tell me who they were about. What about that? This is just an impromptu quiz.
Great.
Stop saying that, you brainless wasp. Do you remember that one?
Pretty Patel.
Pretty Patel.
It was pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you talking about, you drunk blobfish?
That's definitely Boris Johnson.
That's definitely Boris Johnson. And my personal favourite... You're only qualified to govern a country slightly worse than the dog with an oven glove on its head.
That's Donald Trump.
That's Donald Trump. Three out of three, Michael Spicer. Yay. Well done. Excellent. Have you got a little book where you just write them down through the day, or do you sit down with the video in front of you and say, "Okay, I'm going to come up with something to"?
Yeah, the videos themselves conjure up the images.
Right, okay.
So there have been moments where I've kind of struggled a bit and just Googled, obscure vegetables or whatever, and tried to just mix and match, you know.
Right, yeah.
In a way of trying to come up with the best insult that isn't a swear word, because I find that that's far more creative and inventive to do that rather than just rely on a swear word as a punchline.
Way more of a skill. There is the criticism that you perhaps left the left alone a little bit. There is definitely a focus on the right, be it here in the UK or in America. And obviously we want to be very careful at the moment because of the election period, but is that a fair criticism?
Yeah, I guess so. But what I would say to that is they're the ones in power, so they're making the decisions that are ruining everything.
Well, I mean, they would say not necessarily ruining everything.
They would say ruining everything. Yes. And but also an interesting example of that is that when Jeremy Corbyn was leader, I had... And Andrew Neil interviewed him during the election, last election. I had written A Room Next Door for Jeremy Corbyn. And I read it back and I just thought, this is not as funny as the Boris Johnson ones. And I binned it. And that is simply what dictated how I do it.
It's based on
if
the character.
If it's funny...
Yeah.
It's based on the character, so if it's just simply not as funny, then I just won't do it, because I'm conscious of the fact that this character has a shelf life, and if you do a dud, then it could ruin it for the next one. So it really is all about how funny is this, because I honestly don't care who I go for. It's just that on the right, you had this incredible collection of comedy characters at that time. And over on the left with the Shadow Cabinet, I'm very sorry, but they're incredibly dull. Incredibly dull.
Which is a, you know, an insult in of itself. So there you go.
I would love more dull politicians who are actually doing their job would be amazing. But they're not good for parody,
yeah.
For satire.
You have you've amassed a massive following, so about 500,000 people on Twitter/X alone. A lot of those are the people that you've spent a long time lampooning, which is sort of a weird irony, isn't it? It's a strange balance, but I know it's not necessarily something that you take as a compliment.
No, it's not at all. No, I can't bear them. I can't bear it when they follow me.
Why?
Because if I was like a political cartoonist and then they phoned me up and said, oh, I love that cartoon you did of me as a massive giant snake. I want to have that framed and put
can
on
I have
in
a
my
print?
Office.
Yeah.
Can I have a print of it? Well, no, I'm trying to attack you. And in that respect, it's seen as a game. It's just a game. Let's have a laugh. Let's have a pint after this has all died down. Let's have a pint, have a laugh about it. No, don't want to do that. I don't want to know you. I loathe you. I want you to just do your job. And I can't bear it when they follow me. It feels like they've not got the point.
There is a noticeable difference over recent years in the way that politicians act and behave and speak and interview. And there is definitely that every man, every woman persona that so many are desperate for. But also, I find it increasingly difficult trying to get just a straight answer out of any politician I speak to. And I think that's because the media landscape has changed so much that they are so afraid of saying the wrong thing that they quite often don't say anything, which is where I wonder where you get, you know, certainly did get a lot of your content from, because they just don't want to answer a direct question. So they end up tying themselves in knots. You know what I mean? I just think there's been a noticeable difference in the way that politicians, a change in the way that politicians approach interviews now.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's not human at all. And it doesn't do them any good at all if they just keep saying the same thing over and over again. And also, I think after Boris Johnson, when Rishi Sunak came in, although he came in after Liz Truss, but you know what I mean? Rishi Sunak came in, I don't think he pays any respect to journalists at all, because he just says the same five things that he's been given to say and it never answers the question and only seeks to detach himself further from the reality of what, you know, the circumstances that people are living in. If he would just answer, or any politician.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, it's not exclusive to the Prime Minister.
No, I mean, Keir Starmer is exactly the same, quite frankly. And he doesn't, there is no sympathy, there is no genuine sympathy there at all, because politicians are too detached from the real world. That's just the nature of it.
Mm. Sticking with social media, obviously, it still is an incredibly important medium for you. Probably the most. I mean, I know you've got your podcast, you've got the radio, and we'll reflect on that in a moment's time. But there is something about it, isn't there? It's this sort of democratic self-authored medium that allows you just to do it. You can just do it. You don't need TV commissioners anymore. You don't need radio commissioners anymore. It's available to everybody if they want it. It's making the success of it. Or making financial success of it—that's a difficulty. But it is amazing to think about the revolution it's caused in any kind of entertainment medium.
Yes, I think it's definitely revolutionised it. I think that online comedy has—I don't want to say killed, but certainly wounded sketch show comedy on television, for instance, because people get that sketch hit from their phones, from TikTok, from the constant scrolling of from all sorts of different feeds, because, you know, you could conceivably be on eight different social media platforms going through different feeds. And so in that respect, it is difficult to perhaps carve a comedy career solely in film and television these days. But having said that, it is a great ambition of mine to, you know, do shows and make film. But online comedy, I don't know what I would have done without it.
Yeah.
Because I was trying so hard. And obviously, I'm, you know, quite old. And when I started out, there were only four channels. And I was writing to the BBC, ITV and Channel 4, asking to, you know, become part of their world and thinking, what would I need to write to fit their demographic? And really, that's not what you're supposed to do as a writer. You're supposed to write things that you feel interested in, you're passionate about, that you would watch.
Yeah.
And when you create a platform for yourself on social media and you start doing all the things that you always wanted to do, suddenly everybody's coming to you.
Yeah.
And you don't have to go to all of these big industries, these big networks anymore. They're coming to you. And then the door's open.
And there still is that. Even though then there are plenty of comedians out there who are making a good living and a creative living, not in the traditional space, there still is. People still want it, though, don't they? You know, I think I'm fairly confident of the people I know who are in the online world. If I said, look, I know you're a disruptor or you're not treading the traditional path. If someone from BBC Two or Channel Four said, do you want a show? They'd bite their hand off because there is that idea of prestige and we all grew up watching it.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely correct. And one of the biggest thrills in my life was getting a commission on Radio Four because I used to listen to Radio 4 when I was a teenager. I used to listen to the comedy and I used to, well, in fact, when I was 17, I actually went to the BBC because they used to have these open day writing, you know, sessions. And I used to go down there and feel like I wanted to be part of that. And I would bite your hand off if I could get the opportunity to be on the BBC on television or any of the networks, to be honest, and also see a film that I've made on the big screen. You know, I'd love to go to the cinema and watch, you know, a film that I've produced and directed. You know, I've got a few acting jobs where I've been in films, and I just absolutely cannot wait for them to be premiered because it's still that buzz that I still have that's, you know, within me of those times when I was, you know, just a teenager. And that was the media we had.
Yeah,
and I still have a very spiritual connection to the old media, for sure.
That seems like a good point to talk about your new series. So
yes.
Michael Spicer is with us at the moment. We were talking about The Room Next Door, which is what many people will know him from, his satirical lampooning of mainly politicians, pretending to be their special advisor, sat in the room next door, giving them advice on what to say or definitely what not to say. You can now hear him as part of his new show on BBC Radio 4. It's on Sounds, BBC Sounds at the moment as well, which is where it started. And it's great. I listened to it's called No Room. I listened to the first four episodes driving over on the M62 today. And I mean, it's a sketch show in the truest sense of the word. So you have these kind of one-off characters, you have these reoccurring characters, you've got these lovely little vignettes of just one-liners as well. It seemed perfect for you because it was just you being able to do everything you wanted by the sounds of it.
Yeah. So the Comedy Commissioner, Julia McKenzie, said, you should do what you do online and what everyone loves you for and just do it with us. And so I was kind of given free rein to record on the fly, record with my phone, record with my podcast mic at home, go out on the street, record, you know, raw material. And that was the most important thing to me, is that it sounded like perhaps nothing else you might have heard before, because it's like a soundscape.
Yeah.
You've got Augustine Bousfield, the composer, who composed all this original music for me, which was amazing. And it is like a sort of culmination of all these ideas that I've had. And yes, it really did scratch the itch that I've had for a very long time, which is just to do sketch comedy. I know I said sketch comedy's dead, but as I say, I think...
But you are the Lazarus of the sketch comedy world.
I feel like if you get people together to do something creative with that format, then yes, you can breathe new life into it, of course.
Well, one thing it's not is political satire. Well, I guess sort of topical political satire reacting to what is happening in real time, but it is satire of sorts, isn't it? There's a great sketch where there is an ex-extreme right-wing MP on MasterChef, and some great recurring characters of Tim. I think there's a dozen Tims in a room trying to sort out racism and lack of diversity in a big broadcast organisation.
So, exactly. Yeah.
But it's not reacting to what is happening in the world of politics at the moment. Do you miss that aspect of things, or was it a conscious decision not to go near that?
It was a conscious decision to try different things rather than devote 15 minutes to reacting to what was in the news, because we've kind of gone over that ground before. And what I wanted to do was kind of capture those sorts of different social and cultural aspects, such as these think tanks. Occasionally you'll hear about these think tanks, don't will you, about, you know, we've solved racism because we've produced this document. Things like that, kind of, they are sort of cyclical. They do come back into the news.
Yeah.
And they are, and it is, you know, I don't want to say zeitgeist, but I will because it's the only word I can think of. But it's kind of got a zeitgeisty feel to it. It isn't just a general, you know, it's not a dead parrot sketch type of sketch show. It's sort of grounded in satire.
Yeah.
Even though I love the dead parrot sketch, don't get me wrong. But it's not surreal in that aspect.
There's a great sketch where you have a group of government advisors trying to come up with a more media friendly term to the word food banks, and there's some wonderful alternatives. My favourite, which is community nosh closet, which could be a euphemism for so many other things. But at the same time, Michael, it's like, well, I don't know if I could see that as a headline in a newspaper and just think, yeah, possibly. That's maybe what they're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, that came about because Penny Morden tweeted about a food bank and called them food pantries.
I think. That's right. Yeah.
And that's when I thought, oh, I see. They've had a meeting. They've had some sort of brainstorming session with a whiteboard to try and come up with something that doesn't sound as harsh as food banks, rather than solve the problem of food banks. So little things like that, they're just absolutely ripe for parody.
It's 10 episodes long, which feels like a lot of pressure. And there are a lot of deadlines and a lot of material for you to come up with. And I guess the luxury of what you were doing before was it was to your own time scale. And you weren't working for the man or the woman, Michael. You know.
No, I know.
You sold out and went to Auntie.
BBC.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. That's the thing. I love it. I love the BBC. I absolutely love it because it's all there was growing up. That was, you know, it was Auntie, and all my heroes were on the BBC. All my comedy heroes were on the BBC, and it feels incredibly special to be doing a show for them, despite the deadlines.
Yeah. Do you enjoy that aspect of, I mean, how do you write? Are you someone who treats it as a 9-to-5, or are you someone who will just work when the creativity is there?
No, I do, 9-to-3, because I need to do the school run.
Oh, right, fair enough.
That's essential.
I'm getting into that from September, actually, so I need to, we'll talk about that in a minute, yeah.
Oh, okay,
I need some advice on how to deal with it.
Yes, it's emotionally devastating for about the first week, and then you realise, oh, okay,
I've got
a routine here, that's fine. Yeah, got loads and loads of time to do my own thing. So it is 9-to-3, and in the evenings I tend to just wind down, and I don't have writer's block. And if I do have a moment where I think of a great idea and it's not my writing hours, then I do have a notebook and I write it all down. But usually when I'm sat down with my cup of coffee first thing in the morning, it is just, yep, yeah, I'm ready to go. And I usually get, you know, dozens of pages out per day. It's great.
What is it like being a comedian in normal life? I think it must be a lot of pressure. I remember when if I'm in a room and you say, oh, what do you do? And you say, oh, I'm on the radio.
Yeah.
People are kind of like, okay, go on then, entertain us. What do you mean?
Yeah.
I just read things that smarter people than me write for me and talk to nice people like you. I mean, I've got nothing to offer. But a comedian...
it's not true, Johnny.
Inherently, you're funny and you're there to entertain. And people, are they just constantly like, go on then? You know, whole court, make us laugh.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. But the interesting thing is that when I was working in an office, I think if you met anyone who worked with me in an office environment, they'd think I was the most miserable. They'd tell you
really?
That I was the most miserable, really? Uncommunicative, and generally quite boring person. Because what I would do when I would go to work, and the thing is, a lot of the time I was a copywriter, and that did require me to just put headphones on, listen to music and try and get stuff out.
Yeah.
Which means I would never engage in that open office banter thing. And I would just shut myself off from it. Because a lot of the time I just wanted to go home as well. I just wanted to get my work done and go home. I wasn't very interested in making friends. So it was very odd when I started to go viral, but had to still work, because people would come up to me in the kitchen and say, you were on the news promoting a comedy tour last night, I noticed. I said, oh, yeah. Why? You're a copywriter. I do this other thing on the side.
I'm also very funny.
I'm very funny. I am very funny. But no, it's a very weird thing. And when people do expect you to be funny all the time. Luckily, I am.
Yeah, well,
no, that's that. I'm not. No, I'm joking. I'm joking because again, there's another joke there. There is a fine line. What I do get a lot is, this thing happened to me. You can put that in one of your scripts.
Yeah, yeah,
I get a lot.
Yeah, that's the same. You should definitely talk about this on the radio later. Yeah, what you missed your bus. What would you like me to say about that exactly? They don't know you. I don't really like you. Why would I talk about you missing your bus?
Yeah, I've come up with this thing. I missed my bus. It's a six-parter.
Yeah.
Can you read all the scripts? I've got all the scripts here. Could you read them all, please?
What about family life? Because obviously you... Your comedy isn't necessarily based on real life observations
no, not at all.
But do you ever try and work that in? Because kids are inherently funny, as well as, you know, because they are also really stupid and annoying at times. Wonderful, wonderful things. But also they provide a lot of content for daily life. But anything like that, does that ever work into your work?
I don't incorporate it into my work, but I do. I do tweet sometimes if they say something. Like, for instance, my 7-year-old said to me, my top's inside out. And I said, well, just pull it outside in. And he said, inside out, outside in is not the opposite of inside out. There you go.
Work that one out.
And I literally had to stand there for like half an hour working it out.
Yeah.
How did first of all, why isn't outside in the opposite of inside out? And second of all, how did a 7-year-old brain come up with that?
Yeah, they're great.
Just little things like that. So I will, you know, I don't often tweet about them or incorporate them into my work, because I do tend to. I love creating worlds as well, basically, that are so distant from mine. I find that a lot more interesting. But if something happens that I will just probably write a tweet about it rather than anything else.
But I was on the bus with my 3-year-old the other day, and she said, why don't people on buses wear seatbelts? And I just couldn't give her an answer. I thought that's a very, very valid health and safety point that you've made there.
There are so many questions they ask that you can't answer.
Yeah, so it makes you realise that just what lack of knowledge I have about some of the most fundamental things that we do in life. But that's...
Yeah, but... That's everybody.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, that's the thing. That's being a parent is finding out how little you know.
Yeah, really, yeah. And how much you get it wrong.
Perhaps you shouldn't have... and how perhaps you shouldn't have had children because you don't know what you're doing.
Why did we open this Pandora's box?
By then it's too late.
It's far too late, yeah. Are you worried about, or were you worried, maybe not now because you are fantastically successful and it's it's created a wonderful life of luxury for yourself, but were you worried about being pigeonholed as a political comedian or satirist? Yeah, are you worried?
Yeah, from day one I was.
Really?
Because it's all very... it's so fickle. And I think people are quick to pigeonhole you in this sort of game. And what I didn't want to do was just keep doing it over and over again.
Yeah.
There are people who see me or see a sketch on their feed, I know, and then go, oh, God, not this again, this one joke. But the thing about The Room Next Door is that I was aware that it could be just one joke, but I tried every single time I did it to try and take it into a new realm, down a new path, a new creative path. So one, I just turned it into a sitcom, and another one, I turned it into a big reveal at the end that he lives in a parallel universe. And there's another one where I do a Game of Thrones parody. I tried to do something different every time so it didn't stagnate. But when you're doing Boris Johnson and he just keeps falling down the same holes, you can't help telling the same joke. And that's when I realised that I should probably stop. And indeed I did. I mean, I was doing them probably every week. And then I do about three a year because I just was conscious of it getting boring. And I want to do so much else. Yeah.
So is that the idea to maybe phase him out then? Is that the...
Not phase him out completely. I did want to finish. I thought this is going to be the last one. I won't tell anyone. But it just... History kept happening, you know? News kept happening.
They just kept doing it, yeah.
It just kept happening, yeah. And I couldn't put it down. And because the thing also with The Room Next Door is that when I post stuff, you know, I'm still not sponsored by anyone and I'm getting no money for it.
Really? So, you don't get any money for them? Do you not?
No, not those. I mean, I'll get, you know, the MASH Report commissioned me to do some special ones, and the Late Late Show in America...
With James Corden.
..got me to commission... Yeah, with James Corden commissioned me to do six. So that's fine, but I still didn't know how to monetize it on social media.
That's fascinating, but that is such a... You know, that is your calling card, isn't it?
I know.
And you're not making money out of it still? Not enough to support yourself.
So for the for 8 months after I'd come up with The Room Next Door, I was still working. And it was only when I was offered a book deal and a tour in like the same month that I realised that I could actually quit and for a lucky year, and see how I got on. And, you know, at the moment it is just like, well, let's see how I do for this year and let's see how I do for this year.
Yeah.
Because at the moment it's the money is coming in from me doing acting jobs, for instance, that have nothing to do with my writing, which is the irony of it.
It's just astonishing that you would, you know, you were kind of omnipresent, particularly during the pandemic days, and then beyond you were on my phone every day or every week. you were as part of a fixture of my sort of entertainment content as anything else I was watching on telly or listening to on the radio. But you weren't making a living out of it. And these weren't videos that only a small niche of comedy fans saw and still do see. You know, they were part of mainstream entertainment, which I guess speaks to we talked a lot about the benefits of social media. That speaks to one of the major faults of it, is that you have other people, the social media companies, benefiting financially and you don't get to.
Mm. Yeah, that is true. I mean, there was a moment when The Daily Show with Trevor Noah did a sketch which was incredibly similar to mine. And this was at the time when I was doing My Room Next Doors for James Corden. But it was in the week where my book was coming out. So I thought, oh, well, any publicity is good publicity. You can't really complain about this. But Twitter went absolutely ballistic. My followers just hounded them. they were offended on my behalf because of the injustice, yeah. The fact that obviously he was a very a rich money making show in America, and he was me making no money from it at all in my living room. But I just, I didn't feel the injustice as much as everyone else, because I couldn't believe my luck at that point. The tour was happening, the book was happening. I just thought, this is exactly where I want to be. Yeah. All right, I'm not rich, but that was never really a priority anyway. I just wanted enough money to quit my job.
That's the magic trick that the corporations make, though, isn't it? Is making you think that your small lot is all you wanted, and actually they're the ones that are really benefiting from it.
That's true.
What the cynic would say. What are your fans called, by the way? do you have a name for them? The Spices or something like that?
No, I don't, actually. Maybe I should.
You should do.
Maybe I should. There's certainly an element that feel the need to join in with me, like they want to create a double act. but I'm not. I'm such a lone writer. I'm such a solo writer. I've never bounced off anyone in my life. Yeah. So they're barking up the wrong tree there, I'm afraid.
Final couple of minutes, I wanted to ask you, sort of bring it back to where we started. You obviously just wanted to make things funny, and you then fell down this rabbit hole of politics. As you got further and further into it, did you realise that you wanted to change politics?
Oh, no.
Really?
I don't think, no, I'm not. I am just really, when I think about satirists, I think about Ian Hislop.
Right.
You know, when he argues with somebody, he's brought the receipts, you know? He's done his research. He knows exactly the person that he's talking to, he knows about them from beginning to end. He's read their book.
Yeah.
For me, I am still kind of feeling around in the dark. You know, I didn't really know who Priti Patel was until I did the sketch, to be honest.
Really? Truthfully, you didn't?
Well, she's on my radar.
Yeah, but you weren't an avid kind of politics consumer.
I didn't trawl. No, I don't. Before I did Donald Trump, I didn't even know what he sounded like. I just thought, oh, there's Donald Trump. He's bound to say things that Donald Trump says. I don't really want anything to. I don't want to hear him. I don't want to hear his voice. But then, now, you know, well, at that point, I was just editing every single syllable and it was driving me nuts. But in my 20s, the weird thing is that in my 20s, I loved politics. I used to watch PMQs with John Major and Tony Blair when John Major was prime minister. I used to watch them and I was absolutely fascinated by it. I used to watch the Daily Politics shows and all of that. Found it really interesting.
Yeah.
And then I don't know, for some reason, I think I must have got fatigued. Maybe I shouldn't have got into that so early, but I was really fatigued by my 30s and 40s and just sort of tuned out. And it was only Twitter that kind of brought that back, that sort of that urgency, that need for change, bringing that back. Because, you know, we were on Twitter when the coalition happened and this sense of betrayal. So I really kind of get my politics from my social media feeds rather than reading books.
Well,
sitting down and watching the news.
Yeah, but it's, you know, that's true for so many people now. The world is very different, and social media is a place where large swathes of people get their politics and news and current affairs. So you're no different to anybody else in that. Michael, it's been really, really enjoyable talking to you. Thanks for spending so much time with us. Congratulations on the new series. It's called No Room. It's on BBC Sounds in its entirety at the moment. It's on Radio 4, and you can hear the last couple of episodes in the next week or so. And then plans next? Anything you can tell us about that you're allowed to?
There's a second series of this.
Excellent.
No Room next year. I'm working on a short film right now that I'm writing and directing and starring in.
Good.
which is an idea that had been rattling around in my head for about 10 years. And now I'm in a position where I've actually raised some money to make it, which is great. And there are all sorts of other bits and pieces that have come out, but I don't know if I can say because they haven't had been released. But, you know, I'm in a few films, let's just say that.
Well, that is the wonderful Michael Spicer there, leaving us hanging. And just a reminder, you can hear his Radio 4 series, No Room. It's on BBC Sounds whenever you like, and he's still doing those fantastic Room Next Door sketches on social media. Hey, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your company. And as ever, thanks to the team, Kaylee and Paul in the studio, Joe and John producing, and, of course, Adrian pulling all the strings. That's it from me. Enjoy your evening. Stand by your beds. Dotun Adebayo, The Night Watchman, is next.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 1 o'clock. This is Justine Green. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told an emergency meeting of the Security Council that all hell is breaking loose in Lebanon following days of cross-border fire and missile strikes. Israel's most senior general has told his troops to be ready to go into Lebanon to fight Hezbollah on the ground. Mr. Guterres has called for an immediate end to the hostilities and said another conflict needs to be prevented.
An all-out war must be avoided at all costs. It would surely be an all-out catastrophe. The people of Lebanon, as well as the people of Israel and the people of the world, cannot afford Lebanon to become another Gaza.
Within the past half hour, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy has addressed the Council and spoken of Britain's condemnation of Hezbollah's actions.
The United Kingdom condemns Hezbollah's attacks on Israel over the last 11 months, which have driven more than 60,000 people from their homes. There was no justification for these attacks. They have brought misery to ordinary people in Lebanon and Israel, and they have done nothing to end the conflict in Gaza or secure Palestinian statehood.
Mr. Lammy went on to say that nothing justifies Iran supplying weapons to terror groups in defiance of the UN Security Council. The UK government has agreed to send £5 million of humanitarian aid to civilians in Lebanon, which the United Nations will distribute. Network Rail says there was a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations around 5 o'clock last night. Customers were directed to websites containing what the company says was inappropriate material before their Wi-Fi was suspended. An investigation into what happened is underway, as our transport correspondent Sean Dilley explains.
The focus now is to understand how cyber attackers managed to get hold of the Wi-Fi network and target it in the first place. But the BBC understands that it's unlikely customer data has been compromised because no personal information is asked before users are connected.
Two people have been arrested following the death of a woman in Gloucestershire who's believed to have had a non-surgical Brazilian butt lift, or BBL. Detectives are investigating.